uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. What a beautiful day it is. Here in Portland, Oregon, it's a beautiful... I'm assuming it's a marvelous Tuesday for you, wherever you may be. Welcome to our program, broadcast live on radio stations all across the United States, on Sirius Satellite Radio, RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcast on Apple's iTunes, and on CRN Digital. Evan Sayah is a writer, speaker, and pundit in Los Angeles, former communications director in Los Angeles for President George W. Bush. He's been a TV and movie critic and writer with credits ranging from Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher to the cult classic Win Ben Stein's Money and the Discovery Channel documentary The 70s When Decades Attack. And Evan's blog is sayitright, sayitright.blogspot.com. Hey, Evan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you? You know, if I had one more credit, we wouldn't have time for me.
There you go. There you go. Evan, you've got this piece here. Peter Jennings knew there was no truth, and in it, once again, you're making these wild generalizations. In fact, so much so, I got to tell you, I read this and I, it just like it's over the top, Evan, saying that Republicans realize that there is truth, and Democrats think that there is no truth. And for example, you think America is good? Well, we'll show you it isn't by rerunning stories of Abu Ghraib for months at a time. Don't you think that anybody who is rerunning stories about Abu Ghraib is doing so because they love America, they care about America, and they think that America should be held to a high standard?
No. Look, one of the jobs of news people is to put things in perspective. It's not to teach us a lesson. It's to lay out what the truth is. Look, Abu Ghraib deserved to be covered, but 44 straight days on the front page of the New York Times?
Yeah, this is a serious issue. I mean, the United States violating international laws, the United States violating its own laws, the United States breaking laws of warfare that we have held to, in fact, that we helped write over the last two world wars and the last three major wars, including Vietnam. That's a big deal. That is
no,
a big deal, Evan.
No, it's really not. When you have a million soldiers rotating in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and you find four night guardsmen who put panties on terrorists' heads, and they were already...
Evan, we're talking about 30 people who died.
I'm sorry?
We're talking about 30 people who died.
That's not what the Abu Ghraib story was about. That's not how the L.A. Times...
That's certainly a good piece of it. I mean, the reality is that people died. The people were waterboarded. They were held under... People died from this torture.
But that's not what the 44 straight days of coverage was in the New York Times. It just wasn't. It was the same four people, the same England, and I forget the other people's names, and they just ran the same story for a month and a half. Tom, is there any story that you can remember that was front page of the New York Times for a month and a half nonstop?
Yeah, Bill Clinton having sex in the White House.
No, that wasn't.
And you guys were keeping it there every single day. Every single day it was, oh, here's the cigar story. Oh, here's what he... Oh, it was under the desk. No, it was on top of the desk. No, it was around the corner from the desk. Did his cigar... No, did she not know? Who was covering it up? Every day there was something new.
Well, that's,
it was a whole lot more than 44 days, as I recall.
It wasn't straight days, and it certainly wasn't on the in the newspaper of record in the United States. Look, there's no way that the editors of the New York Times sat there and said, okay, when they're budgeting their front page, should we cover the fact that 96% of the Iraqi children are now immunized against disease, or should we have a 44th...
So you think that these people, you think that the folks at the New York Times just hate this country, Evan? Is that what you're trying to say?
What I believe is that they are multiculturalists. Multiculturalists are people who believe all religions, all forms...
Let's get back to this. Do you believe that they hate the United States?
I believe that there is an effort to tear down the United States, yes. I believe that success to them is proof positive of chicanery, and when they find something like four night guardsmen at Abu Ghraib who put panties on terrorists' heads, they're going to shove that down.
Okay, so they're trying to tear down the United States. Now, if somebody wanted to successfully tear down the United States, let's see, pointing out moral failings and holding the United States to a high ideal, that is in your mind tearing down the United States. Hang on just a second, Evan.
Uh-huh.
What about if the New York Times were responsible for example, changing things in the United States so that we could no longer manufacture for example, cruise missiles. And that, in fact, in order to manufacture a cruise missile, we had to go to a communist dictatorship that murders its own people and that has threatened us with nuclear weapons within the past 6 months to do it. Would you say that's tearing down the United States?
That's a long way to go for a big red herring.
No, you said they are tearing down the United States. And I'm telling you, the Bush administration right now is engaging in practices that are tearing down the United States. If you want to use that language, let's talk about really tearing down the United States. Let's talk about George W. Bush.
Okay, let's talk about George W. Bush. But you see, Tom, we're
talking... The point of your article, Evan, is that...
Tom, I get to talk sometimes.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, we're talking past each other. Nobody... You know, the problem is that instead of seeing that this was an abusive practice of 44 straight days, the only other option in your head is to not report it at all. There's certain perspective that needs to be put into place. And for and a month and a half about a story of four night guardsmen who are already being investigated. In fact, the way the story broke originally was that George Bush's government reported it.
Evan, I think that we both know that the Abu Ghraib story is a whole lot larger than four night guardsmen, and it has and it's meta to the entire story of George Bush, speaking of lies, lying us into this war. I mean, that's really the bottom line, isn't it?
No, but that's a lie that he lied us into this war.
Of course, I hadn't made up my mind we're going to war with Iraq.
Yeah, of course, I haven't made up my mind. That was George. Here's just a few of George's war lies.
Hopefully we can do this peacefully. Don't get me wrong. And if the world were to collectively come together to do so and to put pressure on Saddam Hussein and convince him to disarm, there's a chance he may decide to do that. And war is not my first choice. Don't get, you know, it's my last choice.
Now, Saddam did disarm.
No, Saddam didn't disarm. Saddam, look.
Where are the weapons?
UN, wait, the UN that you guys adore, you know, the corrupt one, which I'm sure you didn't actually do a whole piece on, even though they were just caught stealing food from children. But the UN that you rely on, the Security Council vote was for Saddam Hussein to either show us what he did with the weapons or produce the weapons.
And he produced 14,000 pages of documentation. And we redacted 5,000 pages, presumably the ones that had to do with our selling him the stuff when Rumsfeld went over and shook his hand right after he gassed the Kurds and said, well done, Saddam. Good on you, gassing the Kurds there with the stuff that we sold
you. Know, it's funny. I do a bit in my stand-up act where I say how Democrats not only contradict themselves, right in the next sentence, it's George Bush lied to us. He doesn't... about the weapons of mass destruction,
right.
Because he actually had weapons of mass destruction. That's right. And who gave them to him? Well, which one is it? Did he not have them, or did we give them to him?
Well, it depends, Evan. I could say, Evan has mashed potatoes in his hand. I'm sure at some point in your life that was true. It's probably not true right now.
All right, but nonetheless, if
so there's this thing called time.
And if the UN said, okay, we know he had mashed potatoes, and Hans Bleach, a socialist inept UN
and we have a multinational force scouring his country, and we have had the UN inspectors in that country for years destroying his weapons of mass destruction, and we have no evidence.
And when Hans Bleach was kicked out, and he said, they still have not accounted for...
Wait a second. Hans Bleach was kicked out, you just said?
The UN inspectors were kicked out.
By whom?
By Saddam Hussein. All right. Are you actually going to try to sell me that? All right. Saddam Hussein so violated the rules that it made it impossible for the UN inspectors to do their job.
Now, wait a second. I got to hear this. You're really going to try and sell me that?
I'm not going to try to sell you that. That's just a fact.
The reality is that Saddam Hussein was saying, hey, please, come on. Come on, look around.
When are you talking about? When Clinton was president or when Bush
I'm talking about when Bush was president.
Yeah. He said, come on, look around. It was playing cat and mouse games. It wasn't.
He was not.
On,
that's not
around.
What Hans Bleach said.
It was,
you know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced they were witches and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And this is what he said in the context of the fact that he thought within 2 to 3 weeks they would have the evidence. And Bush said, Bush ordered them out because he was going to begin his bombing. And you know that, and I know that. And here's George Bush taking the position that you just took a second ago, which just boggles my mind.
The larger point is... And the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request,
We decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
So there's your candidate lying to us, Evan.
He's not lying.
You think that's worse than the New York Times running an article? You think that that's fine, but it's bad for the New York Times to run an article about Abu Ghraib?
No, what I'm saying is you have two choices here. Either you can say that Hans Bleek was lying and go back and find the 20 other quotes along the way where he contradicted himself from 1 second to the next to the next. So you picked one of 20 quotes from Hans Bleek.
There were Americans with him, too. We had CIA agents in there who were part of that inspection team.
I don't understand what your point.
They were saying there's no weapons. Darfur went in there. He said there's no weapons.
He repeatedly went back and forth. He said 20 different things over and over again. In fact, we're going to have to go back and find the other quotes because he was contradicting himself constantly. And George Bush said, look, this is your last chance, Saddam. No games. Produce the weapons or produce what you did with them or it's over.
And he gave us 14,000 pages of documentation.
Yeah, and they were bogus. And Hans Bleek himself said that they probably have weapons. And even afterwards, Bleek said, I was surprised that they didn't have them. Even Bleek said that.
Because he didn't have a chance to finish looking.
But he knew they were there.
Don't you think, Evan, that before you attack another nation, that you should be sure that they actually represent a threat?
Of course you should, and that's
then how can you stand with George Bush, Evan? How can you stand with this liar and this criminal?
Absolutely a threat. He was the single most destabilizing force in the world's most volatile region. A man who was inciting violence.
Saddam Hussein was more of a threat to us than China that just in the last 2 months has threatened to bomb over 100 American cities with nuclear weapons.
And they actually have the nukes to do it. No, they didn't. They certainly did. No, they didn't. A single general who was not supported by anybody else made that statement.
And then the vice president of the country backed him up 3 days later.
That's not what I've heard.
Well, go back and look. I've reported it on this program. I'm telling you, and I read it in the Wall Street Journal. It wasn't some left-wing website. And there's a lot of people very concerned about it. A lot of old-fashioned conservatives very concerned about that, Evan.
Well, they should be very concerned if America was threatened. I don't understand your point. I mean,
My point is that if you want a real threat, you don't look at Saddam Hussein. You look at the people who actually have nuclear weapons and who are actually threatening us.
No, what you look at is the single most destabilizing force in the world's single most volatile region, a region that's the very hub of Islamic and Arab terror and the crossroads of three countries.
Okay, you want the definition of that? I'd say it's the Wahhabists in Saudi Arabia.
Well, okay, and we disagree, and you know what the difference was? When President Bush said that if we remove Saddam Hussein, he is such a linchpin that democracy will spread throughout the Middle East. And, oh, my gosh, what a coincidence, democracy spreading throughout the Middle East.
Oh, it is it? I understand, yes, that women are going to be allowed to vote again in Iraq, maybe?
I hope so.
I hope so. You really hope the democracy is spreading. We're talking with Evan Sayet. evansayet.blogspot.com, his website. Evan, can you stick around for another 5 minutes here? We got a couple callers who want to talk to you.
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay, hang on. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some cranky right-wing think tank. We'll be back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Gold star mothers, gold star dads, left with nothing but a golden flag. Gold star brothers, sisters too, feel their pain.
That's Country Joe McDonald.
Support the troops.
Formerly of Country Joe and the Fish. His new album, or his new song, Support the Troops. Oil, not in my name. And welcome back, my friends. 25 and a half minutes past the hour. We're talking with Evan Sayet. I got your web URL wrong. It's sayetright, S-A-Y-E-T, right.blogspot.com, and also Evan Sayet, E-V-A-N-S-A-Y-E-T.com. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Let's take a few callers here. Lisa in Indiana on the line. Hey, Lisa, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Actually, my comment is directed to you more than your guest.
Okay.
And I mean no disrespect to your guest. I can't believe you waste valuable airtime having this person on.
Well, the reason I do, Lisa, is because I believe that in your family or in your circle of acquaintances, there's somebody just like Evan. And I think it's really important that people have some sort of a model about how to talk with people like Evan and still be human.
Well, I understand your reason for doing it, but I only get to hear you an hour a day, serious, the way it is. And when I turn it on and this person's on, it is the most frustrating thing for me.
Okay, I got it. I got it, Lisa. Thank you very much.
I just wondered, Tom, did Lisa have any comment about what I had to say, or is it just a general?
No, she doesn't like what you're saying, obviously. Ron in Renton, Washington, on the line. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yeah, I'm listening to this guy too, and I just don't think that he listens to anything else besides the right-wing radio radicals like Rush Limbaugh.
I think you're right, Ron, and probably Evan would agree with you. What do you have a question for him or comment?
By the way, I don't agree.
Yeah, I mean, as far as research, I'm reading the War on Truth right now, and these people have done some research. And I don't know if you're familiar with the book, but
yeah, I am.
If you look at the books that I've read in the last probably two years, I guess. I've read about 10 books here. And even Plan of Attack with Bob Woodward and everything.
Yeah, Ron, I'm sorry, Ron. I've got a minute and a half here.
And by the way, I want to toss out questions for Evan.
John in Greenberg, Pennsylvania.
Bob Woodward's book was... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, Mr. Sayet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you intellectually consistent by insisting that the New York Times was tearing down America when they printed innumerable stories about Whitewater, when in fact two previous investigations, the Pillsbury Report and the RTC Commission Report, cleared the Clintons of wrongdoing? And were they tearing down America when Judith Miller printed all of the administration's assertions about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and critically?
Great question, John.
Here's the difference. The difference is that there was a balance in the Whitewater story. They gave both sides of it. They reported the facts. In the 44 straight days, I think month and a half, every single day, this Abu Ghraib story, which all these years later has gone nowhere, or this year later has gone nowhere.
Nowhere. Because the Bush administration wanted to publicly investigate it?
They publicly investigated. They were investigating it before the New York Times even put it on the air. Lindsay is her first name, I think. Lindy England. You know, she was already being investigated. She was already being, and now she's been punished. The people who were responsible were
punished.
So
you see no problem with Judith Miller reprinting Ahmed Chalabi and George Bush's lies about weapons of mass destruction
for 44 straight days, nonstop, with no balance.
Well, they certainly beat the drum for war. Evan, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it. Evan Sayet, EVANSAYET.com, his website, or sayetright.blogspot.com. Evan, you're a good guy for coming on with us. I appreciate it.
Well, you're a good man for having me.
Okay, thank you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man. And Lord knows I love this land. That's why I'm taking my country back.
SD, my friends.
Been watching you and I don't lie. and my church and flag. I'm taking our country back.
And welcome back, my friends. Yep, taking our country back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I'm Tom Hartman. Evan Sayed is gone. Evan, I really do think that every now and then we need to have the voice of the other side on, and you get a sense of, you know, how do these folks think? What are they saying? What's going on with them? Cindy Sheehan update. Cindy Sheehan, two interesting things going on right now in Crawford. The first is, early this morning, a fellow in a pickup truck came by with chains, put a bar across the back of his pickup truck, and drove over the crosses and the American flags along the side of the road. That's sort of the downside of the news. Destroyed about 600 of them, and 100 of them irreparably. The upside of that, I suppose, if there is to be one, is that he was arrested by the sheriff there in Crawford. And I predict that by this time tomorrow, he will be on Fox News or on Sean Hannity or one of the other hate radio shows, and you will hear him being, you will hear this guy being proclaimed a hero of the right. At the same time, Cindy Sheehan is running an ad, and it is, and you can find out, there are vigils, by the way, on Wednesday of this week, candlelight vigils all across the United States. You go to moveon.org for information on those. Just plug in your zip code, and they'll tell you where the local ones are. Cindy Sheehan is running an ad that is playing in Crawford, Texas, on the local TV station that George Bush might tune into if he decides to watch the local TV. And the whole ad is a close tight-up of her face as she says this.
Mr. President, my name is Cindy Sheehan. On April 4, 2004, my son Casey was killed in Iraq. He was only 24, and he died in his best friend's arms. Casey was so good and so honest. Why can't you be honest with us? You were wrong about the weapons of mass destruction. You were wrong about the link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. You lied to us. And because of your lies, my son died. You said he died for a noble cause. What cause? Mr. President, I want to tell you face to face how much this hurts. I love my country, but how many more of our loved ones need to die in this senseless war? How many more soldiers have to die before we say enough? I know you can't bring Casey back, but it's time to admit mistakes and bring our troops home now.
That Cindy Sheehan, meetwithcindy.org is one of the websites, and of course moveon.org for that information. I have a letter that I wanted to share with you from Abraham Lincoln to Mrs. Lydia Bixby, a grieving widow. He wrote this in his own hand. He said, "Dear Madam, I've been shown in the files of the War Department a statement of the Adjutant General of Massachusetts that you are the mother of five sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any words of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering to you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic they died to save. I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished of the loved and lost, and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Yours very sincerely and respectfully, Abraham Lincoln." Perhaps an appropriate way to respond to a grieving mother. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number. Irene in Leonardtown, Maryland on the line. Hey, Irene, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yes, it's hard to follow that letter and not get a little broken up there.
Yeah, it was Abraham Lincoln was just ripped apart by the Civil War. If you go back and you read some of the histories of it, it's really quite clear that both he and the Confederate folks thought that the whole thing was going to be over in a couple of weeks. And boy, were they wrong. And it just tore him apart.
And you know, you really respect that about him. You can feel good about that president.
I read Carl Sandburg's biography of him some years ago, and it's just, he was just a remarkable man, and he really had the ability to empathize to that was the bloodiest war in the history of the United States on a per capita basis. I think it was 600,000 people died, which for a nation that was relatively small at that time was a huge, I mean, there were no families that were unaffected for all purposes.
I don't think we could even really imagine it.
No.
Now these days.
Yep.
But
so
I, I wanted I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you called about something else, I suspect.
Well, I have, you know, Mr. Sayed was on, and mm-hmm. I was wanting to ask him. I know he's gone now, but he had said that one of the reasons that we went into Iraq was because Saddam was he was threatening destabilization of the area, you know, that he would destabilize the Middle East. Well, I wanted to ask him exactly what's going to happen now, seeing as that, you know, to me, I know that this is maybe politically selfish, but Saddam seems pretty stable compared to the situation we have there now.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is not to say, again, it's so politically incorrect to say, gee, it might be a good thing if there was a bloodthirsty dictator in charge. But the reality is that the United States helped put him in power, and we supported him for a long time. Don Rumsfeld went over, shook his hand after he gassed the Kurds and said, you know, job well done. The Reagan administration was a very enthusiastic supporter of Saddam Hussein. And, you know, sometimes... Well, I don't even want to get into. Sometimes it's useful, or it might, you know, might serve the national interest to make deals with bad people. That's a tough one. But the cost of taking him out was just way too much. Over the top.
The real irony is now you have Iran and Iraq, and I read that Iran has given $1 billion to Iraq for rebuilding their army, and they have co-defense agreement. If we attack one, we attack both. Are we going to fight ourselves?
That's right. If we attack Iran, then Iraq must come to their defense.
And so are we, I mean, we're training the men now, and are they going to be fighting us later?
I'm telling you, Irene, I don't think Bush has any idea what he stepped into. I just don't think he has any idea. Oh, yeah, it's that and worse. Irene, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Nice
to hear from you. Thank you very much. Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention that TV ad that Cindy Sheehan put on, it's on truthout.org's multimedia page.
Okay, great.
And also, if Evan is such a proponent of the war in Iraq, why isn't he enlisting in the military and going over there?
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, why aren't Bush's two unemployed daughters over there either, which is a question that increasingly people are asking.
Hypocrisy to the highest degree.
You could argue that it is. There are very few of these chicken hawks whose families are over there or who are volunteering themselves. Perhaps Tom is willing to. Hey, Tom. Tom in Wabay. How do you pronounce that, Tom in Wisconsin?
Wabino.
Great.
Yeah,
hey, Tom.
Northern Wisconsin.
Okay. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Thanks. I am a conservative. Excuse me. I have voted for President Bush twice. There are a lot of things that he does that I do not agree with. I'm not a Kool-Aid drinker or a water carrier or whatever. But would you, this is not why I called, but I wanted to say, would you meet with somebody that had nothing but mean things to say to you?
Well, I think that you and I both know that what Cindy Sheehan is doing is more political theater than anything else, and it's not the first time it's been done. It's been done, you know, they did it, the Bonus Army did it in 1930, you know, and Herbert Hoover took the bait in reverse and led, you know, had MacArthur and Eisenhower go in there on horseback and break them up and burn them out, and it cost him the election in 32.
Right.
I mean, this is an old trick, and the fact of the matter is, if Bush had any smarts, what he would have done was, when Cindy Sheehan and her sister were the only two people standing there in the sun in Crawford, Texas, 2 weeks ago, he would have gotten in his pickup truck and gone down and picked them up and taken them out and had a beer with them and you know, listened to their story and shed a tear with them and thanked them very much for coming, and that would have been the end of it.
Right. And you know? I don't think the guy that ran over the crosses is going to be propped up as some sort of hero. That's wrong. He should be in jail.
Well, I hope you're right, Tom. I hope you're right. We'll see how that plays out.
But the reason I called is I hear a promotion for your show on Sirius Satellite Radio quite often, and Lynn Samuels and Alex Bennett prop you up as being the smartest one on left-wing radio.
That's sweet of
them. But the promotion that I hear is Bush and the neocons were coming for this group, but I was not afraid. I was not part of that group. Then Bush and the neocons were coming for another group, but I was not afraid. I was not part of that group. But then you say, now the National ID Act, they're coming for the rest of us. How is, and I'm going to hang up because I really do want to hear your entire answer.
Well, actually, you know, stick around and we'll talk about it for a second.
How is the National ID, I really do want to know, how is the National ID Act a threat to the average citizen?
Well, the my problem with the National ID Act is that it specifies that there will be a device in your driver's license that is encoded with biometric data and that can respond to radio frequency signals. So, in other words, you now have something on your body that has your fingerprint or your DNA or your blood type or whatever, you know, something that would identify you, more than your blood type, something that would uniquely identify you, that if somebody, say you're in a crowd of people protesting something, or say, you know, to make it political, or say you walk into a store to make it commercial, all they have to do is sweep it with a scanner, you know, and just look for that chip to transpond, to respond, and they immediately know who you are and where you are and what you're doing at all times.
And now they'll immediately know who's at the protest. Do you honestly think that's why it would be used?
Well, I do, actually. I think that probably the people who are the most enthusiastic about this were the commerce people, the retailers. They like the idea that if you walk into a store and you linger in one particular area, they can know that you know that you have a particular interest in ladies' underwear or whatever, and then they can sell it to you, you know, or fishing tackle. And you know, it's like the Tom Cruise movie, you know, where you walk by and the sign says, "Well, hello, Tom, how are you today?" That kind of thing. I mean, those interests were really pushing for this thing. But they were using the whole thing of illegal immigration as a rubric because those are the same people who like the illegal immigrants. They want to, you know, legalize them. But that's my problem with it.
Tom, I think it's a little paranoia, and I hope you're wrong. But if this is a legitimate fear, then I would be fearful of it myself.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. And I hope I'm wrong, too. I don't say that often. But Michelle DeFord is with us. Michelle was written up in Steve Dean's column today in the Oregonian. And, Michelle, you are – I'm sorry, I don't have the column in front of me. It is. Oh, here it is. Anyhow, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
I'm sorry to keep you on hold there. I thought Scott was bringing this into me, and he already had. It's my bad.
Okay.
You're heading down to Crawford, Texas.
Yes.
Tell us about your story and why you're going to Crawford.
Well, my son David was killed in Iraq on September the 25th, 2004. He was an Oregon National Guard member.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in a Humvee. He was on a supply run by a roadside bomb. I have been against the war since the beginning. My husband and I support David, of course. I'm actually a military family. I'm not anti-military at all.
Right. It's possible to support the troops and not support a particular policy, a particular war,
absolutely,
for example.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, I feel like I must go and support Cindy. I have known Cindy since October of last year. We were working with another organization called realvoices.org. When David was first killed, we just felt like we had to get active immediately and do something so that we didn't have this awful feeling that his life was wasted for nothing.
Mm.
And so we went to Florida with realvoices.org, and that's where I met Cindy. We were trying to help get the vote out. And we've remained in pretty close contact since then. I'm a member of our Families for Peace. When she comes to Portland, she usually stays with us. She is a very calm, articulate, pretty well-grounded mom, I would say.
Cindy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so sure, I understood why Texas.
Yeah.
But I just feel like I have to go and support her. She's certainly not the only Gold Star mother out there who feels the way she does.
Michelle, do you know how many other parents of children who have died in Iraq, like yourself and like Cindy, are going to Crawford or are in Crawford now?
I really don't. I know there is another mother going with me tomorrow.
From Oregon.
From Oregon, mm-hmm. Lynn Braddock-Nall. Her son was killed on July 2nd of 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Blickenstaff, whose brother also died, was going to go, but he's got some home fire problems. And, other than that, really...
So, Michelle, you're breaking up pretty badly here, but I want to thank you and honor the service of your son and his memory, and I don't know how to do that in a way that sounds anything other than gratuitous, but it's not. I what you've experienced is something that, as a parent myself, it terrifies me to even imagine. And so I want to thank you for what you're doing to make sure that fewer families have to experience this in the future.
Well, that's the whole reason for our trip. Yeah. We wouldn't wish this on our worst enemy, and we really, I don't know what's going to bring it to a halt, but something has to.
Yeah.
We just have to do it.
Well, Michelle, you're a brave person, and thank you for coming on our program, and thank you for heading down to Crawford, and let us know what happened when you get back, okay?
I certainly will. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I listen to you every morning.
Oh, great. Well, we'll have to get you on the local show as well, on the morning show on KPOJ. Michelle DeFord has been with us. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
Marine Corps families here in the suburb of Cleveland had already started a makeshift memorial for the Marines killed Monday when word came more died today.
Insurgents and George Bush coming. Hey, soldiers, you're on your own. This summer, Marines are dying. 14 from Ohio. Gotta get down to it. Soldiers are losing their lives. Should have been home long ago.
In Toronto, Ohio, flags and sorrow line the sidewalk.
What if you knew them and saw them dead on the sand? Why are we there, do you know?
The commanders there are doing their very best to understand it. Believe me, they're as interested as you in understanding.
Insurgents and George Bush coming. Hey, soldiers, you're on your own. This summer, Marines are dying. 14 from Ohio.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Paul in Chicago on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Great. I'll make it quick. The guys like Evan, that do you find that it's easy to cash in as a right-wing pundit, more so than a left, that a lot of these guys are just blowing smoke because they know it's an easy buck?
Well, you know, I can't speak for Evan, and I wouldn't attribute those motives to him, although, you know, without personalizing it, I can tell you that what I do know is that if I was doing this radio show as a right-winger, I could be making a lot of money.
Exactly.
And I'm not making a lot of money right now, I can tell you that. And that's just the simple reality. And you know, you go to work for one of the big right-wing think tanks, and they start out at $100,000, $150,000 a year as a decent writer. And
wow.
On the other hand, if you go to work for, you know, one of the little left-wing blogs or whatever, they might pay you 50 or 100 bucks if you write a good article. Most of them, I write for Common Dreams, they pay nothing. You know, I just, you know, they publish it. So, you know, yeah.
That's unreal.
Yeah, so, well, it's just, you know, that's life
these
in the world.
These guys all get the same memo.
Oh,
you
sure.
Know, it's like,
sure. Yeah, they
when
do.
They're attacking Cindy Sheehan, they all say the same thing.
I know. I'm on the mailing list, Paul. Very often I read the memos on the program here. They actually do send out the memos, and they do get them. Paul, I appreciate the call. Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, on Sunday, Howard Dean was speaking to Bob Schiffer, and Schiffer asked him, do the Democrats have a plan on resolving Iraq?
Yeah, and
he basically... You know, he basically said that it's not our job to make the plans, because even if we had them, we're not in place to do it. But here's the simple solution. Put someone like Wesley Clark in charge. He's the expert on the matter. Let him handle it. I can't tell you how to fix a car, but I can find a mechanic who does, you know?
There you go. Good solution, Jeff. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Yeah, Howard Dean actually was very outspoken. Why are you picking on the Democrats? This is George Bush's war. Let's talk to him about, you know, a solution, as it were. The guy has, you know, we had a successful invasion, and then we totally screwed up the occupation, just as everybody predicted. Nobody ever thought that we wouldn't invade successfully, but occupy a country in the Middle East? That's a tough one.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on CRN Digital, carrying us on cable systems across 29 states. Welcome back to the program. Bioneers. Every week we do a segment on Bioneers. Bioneers.org, by the way, their website. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. They're everyday people committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. They're heralding a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. With us today, our bioneer for today is Zenobia Barlow, an activist, scholar, and photographer, and the co-founder and executive director of the Center for Eco-Literacy in Berkeley, California. Welcome, Zenobia.
Hi, Tom.
Am I pronouncing your first name right?
You are.
Oh, good. Okay. Tell us, what is eco-literacy?
I was afraid you'd ask me that. Well, it's an educational strategy, for one, but it's essentially a strategy for children to learn the fundamental facts of life about how nature sustains life.
Why limit it to children?
Well, that's the focus of our effort as a foundation. But of course, one can't really limit it to kids, because if you're working in an educational community, you're working with educators and administrators and parents. So yeah, our focus is on the entire community of the school.
Yeah, we're speaking with Zenobia Barlow. Ecoliteracy.org is your website.
That's correct.
And people can find out more about the program there. It just strikes me that most adult Americans are ecologically ignorant. Is probably too strong a word, or at least it has a pejorative context. Naive, perhaps, is a better word, or uninformed. And if they were to become more literate, more well informed about ecology, not so much in the way that the right wingers portray it, or the corporations portray it as, you know, kind of new age foo foo tree hugging, you know, but the reality that we are part of our environment. I mean, the air we breathe becomes the cells in our body. The water we drink becomes the cells in our body. This is, you know, the food that we eat, which comes from our environment, is us. We are, you know, we're meat, right? We're a living organism, and that we can't live in a biosphere, in an ecosphere that has been severely damaged without damaging ourselves.
Right. Yeah, it's that essential principle of reciprocity and interdependence. I guess one of the reasons we decided to focus on children is this understanding is so experiential. And so children who are open to life and still immersed in life, haven't experienced them as separated off from one another or life, are open to like a complete immersion into this understanding. And this paradigm really requires an experience that later one can build on. David Orr is one of the board members of the Center for Eco-Literacy and an author. And he teaches at a university at Oberlin. And we've asked him many times, like, you know, are we on the right track? Are we doing what we should be doing? And he says that if children learn a sense of wonder really early in life, that all of the other sort of abstract, sophisticated understandings can be scaffolded off of that. But in the absence of a sense of wonder, it's very difficult to have an ecological understanding that is as profound as one needs to have.
Yeah, there's a real difference in our culture, or in the experience of growing up in our culture, between the Aristotelian, if I'm pronouncing it right.
Aristotelian?
Aristotelian. Thank you very much. It's one of those words that I've read for years and years and I've never heard anybody say out loud.
I don't think I've ever said it before.
Okay. The Aristotelian worldview that everything is reducible to mechanical parts, and that, you know, the universe is sort of a machine, and if we can just find the right levers, we can manipulate it however we need to. And the concept that it's all alive, that everything is, you know, for me, I remember I was about 7 years old, I think, and one summer, the church that I went to had this summer thing where one of the families was this elderly couple. They had a farm, And they took a bunch of us kids out, and you know, for an afternoon on the farm. And I remember I'm sitting out there. You know, there's a couple of chairs out there, and some of the kids have gone off and they're playing. And I'm sitting next to this old guy, this farmer. I'm looking back, and he's probably my age, but you know, I was seven then. Anyhow, he was, you know, in his 50s or 60s, who knows. But in any case, I'm sitting next to this guy, and we're drinking lemonade, and we're looking out on the field. On the fields, and there's this row of trees, and there's a forest off in one side, and there's the fields, and the sky is just deep, deep blue. I can still see it, and you know, some faint clouds up above, and you know, there's a dirt road off to the left, and there's a car going down it, and this guy leans over to me, and as if he's imparting some incredible secret, he says, "Look out there at everything, the trees, the plants, the wheat, the," he said, "just look at it all," and I'm looking at it, and then he kind of half whispers, he says, "It's all alive."
Wow.
And in that moment, I just got this, oh, wow. You know, it was just, I mean, right down to the bottom of my feet. I just, all of a sudden, it hit me. It's all alive. You know, the sky, the ground, everything. And it was one of those moments that has, yeah, I would say it has been a source of emotional and spiritual resilience for my entire life.
Tom, you just completely captured the essence of ecological literacy.
Well, that's great. Feel free to quote me.
I mean, both as a concept and as a practice of a pedagogy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this was just, you know, this old farmer. Now you're doing one of the things that you're doing to bring it from the sublime to the practical here. You have this Rethinking School Lunch program.
We do.
And you know, tell us about this.
Well, I don't think we ever in our wildest dreams imagined that we would be focusing on school lunch, you know, but as we became engaged with schools and we sponsored work to bring gardens into school communities and connected them to wetland restoration, we began to discover that one of the most dramatic inconsistencies in schools was what we feed kids and how we feed them.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't. I mean, the hidden curriculum was that was essentially fast food values that they don't matter and where food comes from. You know, I mean, it's invisible and industrialized.
Well, in fact, aren't the some of the fast food companies and certainly the candy manufacturers and sugar drink manufacturers actually involved in participating in developing curriculum for schools, promoting curriculum, writing textbooks?
Absolutely, and they've captured, you know, the $7 billion revenue stream for school lunch. And of course,
billion.
There's about a $7 billion annual school lunch program.
Zenobia,
do
you know what the annual budget is for the National Cancer Institute?
No.
It's $4 billion a year.
Oh my goodness. Well, and of course, the part of the dilemma is that school lunch is partly responsible for generating a multi-billion-dollar public health crisis.
So we're spending more than we're spending for the entire National Cancer Institute on feeding sugar to kids.
Well, hopefully we're not exclusively feeding sugar to kids, but
you get my point.
Yeah, I do. That's what motivated us to design this online guide, Rethinking School Lunch, so that people would begin to understand the complexity of redesigning the school so that the food was consistent with what we understand, that nutrition is connected to cognition. If we really want kids to learn, we need to feed them decently. And one of the most powerful things we can teach kids is where their food comes from.
Yeah. We're speaking with Zenobia Barlow. Ecoliteracy.org is her website, our Bioneers segment here today. The Rethinking School Lunch program, in the abstract or as a program itself, you know, seems like a great idea. I'm curious to what extent this is actually reaching down and touching the kids as opposed to simply talking to the staff of the school or the parents, you know, about the quality of the foods and things like that.
Well, we've really intentionally designed a school lunch initiative in conjunction with Alice Waters so that the innovations in food service are connected to innovations in curriculum. So we see these as, inherently interdependent. We really are designing experiences for kids that connect them to the food.
That's marvelous. And, for example, what would those be?
Well, we have gardens in all of the schools in Berkeley, and we're creating curriculum, and we're working with the teachers to make sure that that the cafeteria experience is integral to the school day, and we're really spending the next couple of years in an experiment to see how that can work.
So it's more than just let's eat.
And let's eat could be a very exciting educational process.
That sounds like fun. Are kids getting? I mean, are there classes around the food, or are there booklets about the food, or do you have? I mean, how does this work? From I'm a child going to one of these schools. How does it work for me?
Well, let's just think about how exciting food, agriculture, diet, nutrition, those are all part of a good academic curriculum. So we're looking at how food can be a living experience, a part of the academic curriculum. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a scope and sequence. That's a sort of technical curriculum word or term. But what's the scope of what we want kids to know, and what's the sequence in which you'll be taught? And we're really looking at the California standards and science benchmarks and showing how we can use food, which is an exciting topic, to make the curriculum more alive and more meaningful and more interesting to kids.
So when they're studying, essentially, I suppose in the third grade it's not called biology. First of all, is this elementary schools, or are you carrying this all the way through high school?
It's a K through 12 strategy. And of course, if you were trying to learn about the cycle of life, that would be more interesting if you had grown a radish and in 35 days harvested and eaten it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Then you're really connected to, hey, this is my radish.
That's right. Exactly. 'Cause then, and also,
I saw the water that went into this.
Yeah, and you care.
Yeah.
You know, you really care about whether it lives or dies.
Yeah, yeah. So there's not just an intellectual understanding, there's also a values understanding.
Exactly. This is the real values education. And it's hands-on, so kids retain what they learn.
So how can, Zenobia Barlow, how can people learn more about eco-literacy?
Well, our website, of course, www.ecoliteracy.org, and they could, when the book is published in the fall, as the third in the Bioneer series, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, our book, Educating Children for a Sustainable World, Eco-Literacy, will be out later this fall, and you can read about that also on our website. You could subscribe to our newsletter and get a scintillating bite-sized essay every month as part of the Thinking Outside the Lunchbox series.
That's great. That's great. And teachers, parents, anybody who's interested in this can...
Absolutely. And I wanted to ask you, because I could see that every time you travel somewhere, something really dramatic happens in the world.
Oh, no.
I was just wondering, where are you headed next?
I'm not.
Because I didn't know if I wanted to plan to be there
or to just watch it. You've been reading the wrong bio. Zenobia Barlow, ecoliteracy.org. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Keep up the great work. You're doing wonderful, wonderful stuff. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Beat the drum, wave the flag. Those who won't be coming back.
It's Country Joe McDonald.
Numbers rise, build another wall.
Yep, it's Country Joe McDonald of Country Joe and the Fish, his new song, Support the Troops, in which he rather takes Mr. Bush to task, shall we say, and a marvelous song, countryjoe.com is his website. Welcome to Ellen Ratner, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, well, okay, a few interesting things, one or two ugly things.
Uh-oh. Let's start with the ugly stuff.
The ugly stuff is that the New York Times reported that this woman Perot's husband, you know, who's been in jail, Al Perot, and his illegitimate daughter.
Wait a second. No, I don't know a woman Perot who's been in jail.
Okay, she's the one that's running against Hillary Clinton, one of the people.
Oh, okay, New York State, the
right.
Republican who is going to be running against Hillary.
Well, okay. You know, her husband was in federal prison.
Yeah, I had heard that. I must have repressed it, but yeah.
Well,
okay, yeah.
Apparently now the New York Post reported that he had sought to make up with his illegitimate daughter to take that issue off the table during his wife's run against Hillary Clinton.
Oh, isn't that sweet of them?
Now, today, the New York Times is reporting that he and his illegitimate daughter are not, that's not the reason they're making up.
What would be the reason? That they're decent people and it's a good thing to make up?
I guess so.
Well,
I guess so.
Oh, I see. So they're really making up to help her campaign, but they can't say that they're making up to help her campaign because that would sound like they're just doing it to help her campaign. So the timing is merely coincidental.
That's right. You should have written Catch-22 so you understand the dynamics.
It took me a minute to get it. I confess. It took me a minute.
Okay. And of course, you know that Governor Bill Weld of Massachusetts is considering becoming the governor of New York. I once did an interview with him in my studio here, and he said to me, oh, I think it'd be kind of cool to be governor of two states.
Wait a second. No, I didn't know that. The former governor of Massachusetts
lives in New York.
Oh, lives in New York now.
Yes.
Okay.
Has for about 5 years.
Okay, well, that gets him halfway
banker.
There. Yeah, that gets him halfway there. And he's got a big pile of money, right?
Right, and he's thinking of running, for the open seat.
Well,
of course, he'd be running against Elliot Spitzer.
Yeah, well, Elliot Spitzer, I think, has a lot of support in New York.
I think so, too. So I think it'd be a very tough race for Bill Weld.
Yeah, Spitzer's going to run as a Democrat.
Bill Weld is quite a liberal in some respects. He was very good on gay rights, very good on women's issues.
Yeah, even though he's a Republican.
Yep.
There are a few of them out there, decent Republicans. But so Elliot Spitzer is definitely running as a Democrat.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry I have not been so laser-focused on New York news.
Okay, well, the Consumer Price Index has gone up 0.5% last month, but it...
How can it only be 0.5%, Ellen, when the cost of gasoline has doubled?
Gas has gone up 6.1%, because let's say you have a friend like my friend Brenda Notini. Now, Brenda is a wonderful hairstylist. She's got her own little shop. She's now beginning to experience the prices as it begins to get colder, or will get colder in New England. She hasn't needed, it's fairly cool. You don't need the air conditioning on all the time like you need in Washington, D.C.
Right.
As September rolls around, mid-September, and it gets cold, she is going to really be up a creek. So she's going to have to raise her prices at her beauty salon.
Mm-hmm.
To a higher, a higher amount, and then what's going to happen is that her price increase, in other words, the fuel prices have not yet seen the increase because
right.
they happen too quickly.
Right.
Watch the sort of boomerang as that little ball comes down, rolling down the alley in around November, December, and you're going to see big prices.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. Five of the last six recessions since World War II were preceded by spikes in oil prices.
You got it.
Five out of six of them, including the last Bush recession. Here we are all over again. Another Bush recession coming at us. Ellen Ratner, thank you so much for being
with us.
You're welcome. Okay, we'll talk to you tomorrow, Ellen. Much appreciated. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Just take what you need. Don't empty out this month.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you'd like to drop in and say hi to some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. Yeah, the folks in our chat room there, our live chat room, just click the live chat, or you can participate on our blog, on our message area, if you'd like, just click that, the blog message area line. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Will, what's up?
Good morning to you, Tom. A wonderful show as always, and thank you for taking the call.
Certainly.
That letter that you read from Lincoln, by the way, you are my the third hero, Tom, Thomas P. campaign is my first one, Thomas Jefferson, second, Lincoln, and Golda Meir, and also Pericles, by the way.
It's a great collection.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, love your show, man.
Thank you. So what's up, Will?
Would you mind very much if you read that letter once a week and dedicated to all the widows, orphans, and mothers and fathers? That is a gut-wrenching letter.
Yeah, well, it's a nice sentiment. I can't make a commitment on the air, but...
By the way, Pericles...
Appreciate the suggestion.
I thought it was beautiful. And I lost 300 books, and I don't have my reference library anymore. But Pericles, during the Punic Wars, wrote something or addressed the women and the mothers of when they had to go off to war. And it was another beautiful, beautiful sentiment. I mean, just...
Well, the bottom line here, Will, is that with Abraham Lincoln and Pericles, and I think perhaps even, you know, Alexander the Great, for example, you know, some of these historic leaders who did lead their nations into war, they understood what the consequences of war would be. And they went into it with their eyes wide open. They suffered through it. They dealt with the agony of it. Some of them came out the other side intact. In the case of Alexander the Great, he didn't. They were willing to pay the price, and they realized that there was a price to be paid. I don't think George Bush thought that there was a price to be paid. I think he thought that this would be like everything else in his life. If he got in trouble, his daddy's friends would bail him out, or the Bin Laden family would bail him out, like they did with his failing business, Arbusto. And nobody's running in to bail him out. Well, actually, I think you could say his daddy's friends, or the Republicans, you know, are trying to bail him out as hard as they can, as fast as they can. You got Fox News out there and right-wing talk radio and all this, you know, all these bloviators who are, you know, trying, oh, everything he did is just, oh, you know that there's weapons of mass destruction, you know, blah-de, blah-de, blah. So maybe there is some reality to his perception, you know, tragic as it is. But anyhow,
you remember,
my take on that.
I'd like to have a nomination for Ugly American. And first off, it's Bill O'Reilly.
O'Reilly, yeah.
And I would love for you to, by the way, you have a wonderful gentleman, Scott, your radio man. William Lederer was the co-author of The Ugly American. I still have managed to save a couple books. I still have the original copy, A Nation of Sheep. You remember that book?
I do. Will, I've got to move along, but I appreciate your comments, and thank you very much for calling in and sharing what you did with us. And apropos to your thoughts on Mr. O'Reilly, just to hold up the Ugly American for a moment.
Well, the shut-up line has happened only once in 6 years.
You want to know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing?
Shut up.
I'm asking you to shut up about
the person who cut his mic.
No,
hey,
that's
shut up.
No,
you had your 35
up.
Minutes. Shut up.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. Okay. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
There you go. If you're truly a patriot, you don't shut up. You speak up. Speaking of speak up, Joe in Brookings, Oregon, your turn to speak up. Joe, what's up?
Yeah, interesting you bring up that neo-McCarthyite scumbag, Bill O'Reilly, because, obviously the Bush administration, obviously they figure there's no way they can go ahead and arrest this woman or do anything like that. That would be terrible public relations. So what are they going to do? They're going to sick the Fox News Channel and all these other people in the right-wing media on her to make her look like some kind of communist dude.
Well, here in fact, is O'Reilly about Cindy Sheehan.
I mean, I think Mrs. Sheehan bears some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
So she's responsible for the deaths in Iraq now.
Oh, yes. Well, this.
You know, there were no deaths happening before Cindy Sheehan spoke up.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill O'Reilly. This is the same guy who was lecturing John McCain about what is and what isn't effective when it comes to, techniques of interviewing, prisoners.
You're kidding.
No, he did. He did.
You're kidding.
You know, of course, as we know,
John McCain was a prisoner of war for 5 years in Vietnam, and Bill O'Reilly, I believe it was 5 years, and Bill O'Reilly's lecturing him about how to interview prisoners.
That's right. He says, well, you know, basically I know better because I'm Bill O'Reilly.
I'm sorry, Joe. I should have known that, I'm sure. But I am just every day there's something that amazes me. I guess, you know, it's kind of one of the wonderful things about life and about doing a program like this is every day you learn something new. And anyhow, it's a okay. Well, Joe, is that what you called about?
Just one more thing I want to add. I would want to say to all the parents out there, don't let your sons and daughters join the military because this government don't give a damn about them.
Well, tragically, it's not this government; it's the Bush administration. And
well,
you know,
but I think it's been true for a while. And when they come back as veterans, I mean, it's happened for a long, long time. I mean, everybody cheers for them when they're soldiers and they're going over, but they make it back as veterans. This government doesn't give them a damn bit of help, or not nearly as much as they should.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Joe. And we have not been taking good care of our veterans since the Vietnam War, tragically. The last generation of veterans who you know really had good benefits were the GIs from World War II. The GI Bill and the veteran, you know, for education and veteran home loans for housing and things. It helped build the American middle class. And then the Republicans came in and said, oh, that's communism, you know, Nixon and all that. Anyhow, don't get me started. You know the rant. Joy in Santa Cruz, California on the line. Hey, Joy.
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I have a comment about Evan.
Okay.
First of all, I think he must be living in an alternate reality because the planet that he's talking about is not the same planet that I know exists.
Yeah, well, he's a Republican. That requires a certain. Well, it's seen there. Now, I'm doing what he does, okay? Because there aren't. All Republicans are not living in blinders. But yeah, there's a certain small subgenre of folks who certainly, you know, see the world through a very, very clear prism. You know, it's.
Yeah, well, what I recall is he was talking about the inspections and stuff like that. When Bush was sitting there saying that that Saddam wouldn't let the inspectors in,
mm-hmm.
I was watching on the television bulldozers destroying the El Sayud missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right there, I think it was the same day. And the inspectors were there on the ground when Bush was saying they won't let them in.
Yeah, just so the people know what you're talking about, for those folks who might have just tuned in, here's George Bush explaining to us why we had to go to war in Iraq.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power, along with other nations, so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
And those other nations are coming up next.
Yeah, really.
Anyhow, so there's George Bush. You know, make sense of that one. You know.
But why does Evan not recall reality? I mean, that's what happened.
Well, because it doesn't suit his purposes. And, the reality, Joy, is that, you know, we all at some level at various times filter reality. It's part of the survival mechanism of human beings, first of all. I mean, we have to, you know, there's millions of inputs at the biological level all the time. We have to decide what we're going to focus our attention on in order to simply function, in order to walk down the hall. But there's also, I think, in the political sphere, there's a filtering, there's a framing process that we use, whether it's psychological defense or whether it's simply the worldview, you know, the place from which we're observing the world or the lens through which we observe the world or whatever the appropriate metaphor is, the story that we tell ourselves about how the world is. And one of those stories is that the world is a dangerous place and that people are fundamentally evil and that therefore
that's fear-based reality.
Yeah, and it's really the founding principle of conservative thought. I mean, it very much is, and they will proudly own up to that therefore you have to have a strong authoritative force and, you know, strong religions with scary gods to keep people in power, or keep people in line, rather. And then the other side believes that the fundamental nature of people is to be fundamentally good, and then when people are behaving in an evil fashion, that's a sickness, that there's something, you know, wrong that can be healed, or if it can't be healed, at least they can be isolated from society. And
I think there's something fundamentally wrong with people who hold the former viewpoint, though, because they consistently lie.
And it's lying. It's not just a prism, because it's they do it all the time about everything, including people like Cindy Sheehan. They do it to her. They do it to John Kerry. You know, they totally misconstrue everything.
Yeah, I just wrote a review for BuzzFlash.com about this new book on, actually it's not a new book, on Leo Strauss. It's been out for a few years. And if you go to BuzzFlash.com, you can find the book review. And
I will.
And it's a marvelous book. It's called Leo Strauss and the Rise of the Neoconservatives, or something like that. And it's one of the points that they make in there is that Strauss made the point to his students, and Wolfowitz is his most famous student, although, you know, Wolfowitz has influenced a lot of the others, but Doug Feith and Richard Perle and all these guys who were inside the administration, and ultimately Cheney and Rumsfeld as well.
The crazies.
Yeah, and Jeb Bush also, you know, all of these Straussians, that Leo Strauss himself made the point over and over and over again that it is entirely appropriate to lie to people if that lie leads to a greater good. And, you know, it's the equivalent of, yes, that dress looks beautiful on you, you know, or that kind of thing. You know, the little white lie that keeps the relationship intact, that, you know, Strauss says that's how it should be in international politics and in national politics, and that there needs to be, you know, even if it's a big lie, that it's acceptable if the end is so great that lie, that means, justifies it. And that ends justifies the means thinking is, of course, you know, what we saw animating the Third Reich.
Machiavelli.
Yeah, it is. It's Niccolo Machiavelli all over again. I mean, you could go back and read The Prince. In fact, I did about a year and a half ago. I wrote an op-ed piece for Common Dreams about The Prince, about Machiavelli, and how he's been just picked up by these guys. You know, and it's just You go through chapter by chapter by chapter, and it's like a handbook on how to be a Republican in the media these days, and in public life, you know, in office.
So is George Bush the prince?
When Machiavelli wrote the book, of course, he was writing suggestions to the prince of, I don't recall, I think it was the prince of Venice, when Venice was a separate state, an autonomous state at that time. And it was one of the Italian provinces. And he was trying to get Machiavelli wanted to become an advisor to the prince. He never actually got that. He kind of retired in obscurity. And his book then kind of outlived him, certainly outlived him, outlived the prince. I don't remember who the prince was, for example. But, Bush is he's the recipient of that advice. And the Machiavellian character, of course, is Karl Rove. He's the student of Lee Atwater and the guy who has engineered all these things very proudly. I mean, you know, Bush points to him.
Don't they read, doesn't Rove, like, read The Prince every year? I think I read that somewhere.
Well, if he did, I would be amazed if he ever said it. Joy, I got to move along.
Okay.
I thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. Thank you very much.
Bye.
1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Denver, Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Regarding the caller earlier who asked about where you talked about the RFID.
The Real ID Act, yeah.
Yeah, one thing people should be aware of is there are two types of chips, and both of them that can be read for up to, like, the passive chip can be read by up to about 6 meters, so about 20-some feet, and the other chips, the active chips, can be read from much further, you know, tens of meters, perhaps 20 meters or
something. Well, that's with today's technology. I mean, you know, give us another year or two. I mean, they've got these things now that they're implanting in pets and in kids that they say that, you know, they can fly over a city with a helicopter and find somebody.
Yeah,
and so that's a lot more than 6 meters.
Yeah, and to me that's unreasonable search. It's that way, and the thing is, anyone who really wants to bypass these chips, there are things that can be done so that you'll be reading the people who aren't doing anything wrong, where people who you need to keep track of can get away with things.
It's the same problem with airline security. You know, they're frisking granny. And there have been enough times that people have challenged that security by trying to sneak things on. I mean, you know, in people that the TSA themselves, you know, doing it to themselves. And, if somebody's really determined to get through, they're going to get through. I think the TSA thing, you know, I salute them, you know, for the good work that they're doing. It is important. We do have to have airport security at some level. But we also all have to recognize that a lot of this is PR. A lot of this is show. And the bad guys will get through. And like with the RFID chips, yeah, I mean, I've already seen things about how if you wrap your driver's license in tinfoil, then they can't scan you, for example.
Yeah, and they're already using the chips right now. I mean, one example is going through a toll gate, the people who have the tags in their cars.
Right, yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You're being read at 70 miles an hour.
Yeah, well, you got to slow down to maybe 10 or 15, but yeah, I get it. Yeah.
Not here. We drive through fast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got very sensitive readers. I don't have one of those things, never have, but I was in the car with somebody who did a week or so. Yeah, it was last weekend in New Hampshire, the weekend before last in New Hampshire, and he had to nearly stop before that thing read his chip. But I guess, you know, that must be old technology.
Yeah, so they can keep track of all this stuff, and when you have this big database that has your picture and everything, and then once a store reads your ID once, if it's not encrypted, then they can access all these different things about you.
Sure, sure. Pull up the credit reports, get their address, and the next thing you know, you go into that store, and you know, a sign says, "Well, hello, Jeff. Welcome back."
Death of privacy.
Yeah,
yeah. The death of privacy.
Yep, it really is. It's the final death of privacy. We've been watching the slow erosion of privacy over the last 30 years, and now it's getting quite rapid. Jeff, thank you for the call, and for pointing that out. It, well said. Two candlelight vigils, join with MoveOn.org, True Majority, and Democracy for America in organizing or attending a vigil for Cindy Sheehan in your town tomorrow, Wednesday, August 17th. Check it out. Go to MoveOn.org and just plug in your zip code, and it'll come up, you know, with the, where the vigil is in your area, and certainly something worth participating in. It's 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
What gives you the right, hey you, to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me who gave you the power.
And welcome back. Hey, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Just a quick heads up, I wrote a piece about Jefferson would stand with Cindy Sheehan, which was published yesterday afternoon on commondreams.org. So if you go to commondreams.org, you can find it. It's also on buzzflash.com. Ron in Austin, Texas on the line. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
How you doing? I just heard a little bit about Leo Strauss earlier. You're speaking. I'm sorry, about a second radio commentary. I talked about him this week. I'm getting my master's in Leo Strauss, believe it or not, at the University of Texas. I wanted to talk a little bit about Leo Strauss, if you don't mind me saying so. He's the most unquotable philosopher we've got.
He was intentionally ambiguous. He was, you know, he was essentially, you know, paranoid. He was convinced that everything had to be shrouded in layers of meaning.
Well, that's why nobody's quoted him on anything. That's why you can't read any, right, you can't read any quotes from him. But here's the thing. He grew up Nazi era.
Yeah.
He had liberal ideas like we did. I'm a liberal as well. But here's the thing. He comes, sees what the Nazi regime did, and he gets a little more conservative. Now, he himself was non-religious. We know the religious right wouldn't like that about him. But because he looks to Aristotelian ethics, which is, yeah, if someone says, hey, hold my sword for me, would you? Somebody comes and give me my sword, I'm going to go kill my other friend. He just upset me. Well, yeah, you're going to lie to him. So there's justifiable lies, but you can't apply that to living politics, is what I think Leo Strauss and Eric Voglin and Alistair McIntyre have also all stated. You can't lie about living politics, but you can do the small lies for justice, but not political justice.
Yeah, and Strauss also was, you know, agreed with Karl Marx that while religion could be the opiate of the masses, I guess that's where he digressed from Marx. He thought that actually that was a good thing. Marx thought it was a bad thing. And he suggested that there should be a national myth and a national religion, even if that religion wasn't his religion.
Absolutely right.
It's very ironic that this guy who grew up and essentially escaped the Holocaust came here and started spreading essentially what could be argued to be very fascistic ideas. Ron, thanks for the feedback. We got to move along here. Josh in Timbuktu, Kansas. Josh, we're just about out of time. What's up?
Yeah, about the RFID chips. You can either use a Fritos bag or an anti-static bag that your computer chips come.
Oh yeah, those.
Mail.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. And just put your RFID chip in there, and they can't read it.
Okay, and then they say, "Where's your chip, sir?"
Yeah.
There you go.
It's in my Fritos bag.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Josh. This is great. I mean, a whole new technology, a whole new industry emerging from the Real ID Act. No doubt about it. It's coming, my friends. We're going to get back to why aren't the Bush twins in the military? After the news at the top of the hour.
have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Glad to have you back with us. Thanks in large part to Cindy Sheehan, writes, or Sheehan, I guess is how she pronounces it, writes Richard Bradley on the HuffingtonPost.com. Thanks in large part to Cindy Sheehan. People are starting to raise the issue of why Jenna and Barbara Bush are not serving in the military. Now, you know, he points out this is, you know, might be perceived by some as an indelicate question. You know, is it fair to say to the president, hey, you know, you want us to go to a war that you think that we have to have, that, you know, the majority of us think we shouldn't have had, the majority of us were opposed to before we started it, the majority of us have been opposed ever since, should we do that? He says there is precedent for prodding Bush on this question. Back in 1993, when Bill and Hillary Clinton were in the White House, or Bill Clinton, you know, was president, Hillary lived in the White House, they decided to send their daughter Chelsea to a private school rather than a public school. And there was a lot of discussion about it in the press. The Republicans made a lot of noise about it. The Bill Clinton was asked in a news conference right up front, sir, you are an advocate of public education. Why then are you sending your daughter to a private school? And he defended the decision. Now, and I would say that, frankly, that was an even more private matter than Bush and his daughters, because at that time Chelsea was a minor. And Jenna and Barbara are adults. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty simple. As Richard Bradley points out, the military doesn't have enough soldiers. The president believes this is a good and just war. He has two daughters who could enlist in the military but haven't. Things just don't add up. So here's the question that a White House reporter, says Richard Bradley, should ask the president. President Bush, if your own two daughters won't enlist, how can you expect anyone else's children to join the military? This is a variation on the question that was asked of Bill Clinton. If your own daughter's going to a private school, how can you expect Americans to, you know, trust you about sending their kids to public schools? Yeah, I think there's some validity there. Dr. Alan Cooperman is with us. He's an assistant professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and a senior policy analyst for the Nuclear Control Institute. And has some concerns. He recently wrote a piece in the New York Times, an excellent piece, and has some concerns about the export of bomb-grade uranium. Dr. Cooperman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for being with us. Senator Pete Domenici seems to have been a one-man lobbying group here.
Well, I wouldn't say he's a one-man lobbying group. There's some other folks who share the blame, including Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, Senator Kit Bond of Missouri, but Domenici of New Mexico definitely played the crucial role at the crucial moment in getting this enacted into law, and it has been signed into law by President Bush.
Is this, first of all, is this a partisan issue? Is this something, all the ones you named are Republicans, are they not?
Yes. You know, initially it was not a partisan issue. It's true that this offensive legislation was sponsored by Republican Richard Burr of North Carolina, but when the Senate held a vote on it, the Senate actually voted to reject this amendment and to keep
the Republican-controlled Senate voted to reject it.
The Republican-controlled Senate, and it was a mixed vote. Both mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats voted to reject this by a vote of 52 to 46. But then, when it went to conference with the House, the provision magically reappeared, and then the Senate conferees held a vote, and Domenici ensured that every single Republican voted for this provision.
So for our listeners who are not familiar with the piece that you wrote in the New York Times,
right,
which I thought was brilliant, give us a quick snapshot of exactly what this bill, this provision in the energy bill, is about and why we should care.
Okay. Just as some quick background, what's at issue here is the production of medical isotopes. And medical isotopes are a good thing, and everybody thinks that they're a good thing.
Isotopes being radioactive substances derived from or on the same, the actinides level on the periodic table as uranium?
Yeah, things like molybdenum, technetium, which are used for diagnosis and in some cases even treatment of illnesses. But the thing is, you can produce them two ways, either using bomb-grade uranium, which if stolen can be made into a Hiroshima-type bomb by a terrorist, or you can make them from low-enriched uranium, which cannot be turned into a bomb.
Is that like the infamous yellow cake that Niger supposedly was selling to Saddam?
Well, yellow cake can be turned into either low-enriched uranium or highly enriched uranium.
So that's the starting point, is the yellow cake.
Right. So what the old law said was that if there's anybody out there that is producing medical isotopes with bomb-grade uranium, we will only supply that material if they convert, if they're working to convert their production to low-enriched uranium. And the idea was we phase out and thereby end all exports of bomb-grade uranium, and we block a path to the bomb for terrorists.
Right.
That was
makes
the
sense.
Old law.
Makes sense.
It makes very good sense.
How long has that been law?
That's been on the books since 1992, and it was an amendment originally sponsored by Chuck Schumer of New York.
Okay.
What this new amendment does, the Burr Amendment that was supported by Domenici, what it does is it takes this law off the books, and it says, if you produce isotopes, we will continue to send you bomb-grade uranium ad infinitum.
Forever.
Forever.
As long as you want it, as much as you want.
Yeah. Because
why would Pete Domenici be pushing this? I mean, this is the question of your article, the Senator's Gift to Terrorists. We're talking, by the way, with Dr. Alan J. Cooperman, that was published in the New York Times last Friday. Why would he do this?
You know, it's a very good question. It's not clear. He never stated why he was doing it. Certainly, those members who were supporting this legislation had gotten contributions from this coalition, including these foreign companies that want the bomb-grade uranium.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing, especially Richard Burr. The other thing is Domenici.
So, wait a second. You're saying that these guys might have sold out their country for money?
You know, you never know whether they're being rewarded for their position or their position is being encouraged by these sorts of contributions. But there's a very strong correlation between those who were receiving the campaign contributions and those who voted to increase exports of bomb-grade uranium.
Wow. Okay.
Second thing is that Domenici seems just not to think that bomb-grade materials are a great risk of terrorism, whereas I think most people think the opposite. The quote that I put in the article was from a former Manhattan Project physicist, Luis Alvarez, who said that, and this is a quote from a physicist on the Manhattan Project, he says, if terrorists can get a hold of this modern weapons-grade uranium, the background neutron rate is so low that terrorists, if they had such material, would have a good chance of setting off a high-yield explosion simply by dropping one half of the material onto the other half. Even a high school kid could make a bomb in short order, unquote.
Yeah, if for those folks who didn't, you know, take physics 101 in high school or college or whatever, I mean, basically the way a nuclear bomb works is you have two separate pieces of highly radioactive material, and you set off a small explosion near one of them, a detonator. It jams the two together, and that starts the fission process. It starts the reaction that boom, you've got a bomb. I mean, it's really very simple.
That's exactly right, and it's especially easy with highly enriched uranium. But Domenici.
By the way, have we just violated the Patriot Act by saying this out loud on the radio?
Let's hope not.
Let's hope not. Isn't it bizarre that anybody would even ask that question? You know, that I would even... Anyway, pardon me.
The point is, you know, why did Domenici do this? And he seems just not to take this stuff very seriously. He's also promoting the increased reprocessing of nuclear fuel, which would separate out weapons-usable plutonium. And he's saying we should have a whole industry, which was stopped 30 years ago on a bipartisan basis by Presidents Ford and Presidents Carter, who both thought this was kind of nuts, in terms of national security. Domenici is also in favor of that. So he
And again, Domenici is getting money from that industry, right?
And, you know, he's from New Mexico, and there's that's where the uranium industry is based in the United States. You know, again, the question now is what to do. This law is on the books.
This got enacted
and signed by the president. So these foreign companies hit the jackpot. They think that they're going to get, and they're legally entitled to now, increased exports of bomb-grade uranium. We send these things to Canada. We'll send these things to Western Europe. Under our agreement with Western Europe, they can then re-export the bomb-grade uranium to Eastern Europe without even telling us.
Who can then, in turn, re-export it to
whoever
they damn well please.
Who knows? You know, you know, that means that our material, which we may export to France, could wind up in the Czech Republic. And who knows where their connections are, too.
Right.
So this thing really needs to be reversed. And what that's going to take is a lot of public pressure on Congress, on Domenici, on Richard Burr, on Kit Bond, and everyone just writing in, calling their Congress person, and saying they want this thing reversed. It could be reversed this year on another piece of legislation.
So should our listeners be calling their particular senators or their particular member of Congress, or should they be calling Pete Domenici?
I think both.
Both, okay.
I think
and
both.
You can reach, by the way, any member of the United States House of Representatives, any member of the United States Senate, toll-free. It's an absolutely free call, simply by dialing 1-877. This is the old Senate Office Building toll-free number. It's an unpublished number, but it works. 1-877-SOB-USOB. It really is true. As I said, it's the old Senate Office Building number. 1-877-SOB-USOB, and that will get you, and then that gets you the Capitol Hill switchboard, you know, the operator on the Capitol Hill. And for that matter, you can ask for the White House and just say, I'd like to speak with Senator Domenici's office, or I'd like to speak with Senator, you know, in my case, it would be Senator Smith or Senator Wyden, and just ask for your senator's office or ask for your member of Congress and say, you know, I'd like to speak with Congressman or Congresswoman so-and-so. And if you're not sure who your member of Congress is, give them your zip code and they'll tell you.
That's a great suggestion. You know, and the reason it's so important is that the other side is putting out all sorts of disinformation. These foreign companies hired a lobbyist in Washington. That lobbyist then put out these claims that if the law wasn't changed, there was going to be an interruption in the supply of medical isotopes, which is not true. The world production capacity is 250% of demand at the moment.
But it's just that the American companies would lose out in some of that market share.
Well, the ones that we supply would lose their market share.
Right.
But it is, you know, certain companies are already producing isotopes with low-enriched uranium. And, in fact, there's a company in the U.S. that wants to produce isotopes with low-enriched uranium. But now they're going to have a hard time getting funding because these foreign companies just got this gift.
Oh, so it's actually working against the interests of an American company that's making the legitimate. That's using this legitimately.
Exactly.
This is incredible. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Alan J. Cooperman wrote the piece called The Senator's Gift to Terrorists in the New York Times Friday, August 12th, and worth checking out. I believe it was also carried on commondreams.org, which means it would be archived there. And contact your senator, 1-877-SOB-USOB, and let them know what you think about this. Dr. Cooperman, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
I appreciate it. It's and good work you're doing. Keep it up, please. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Someday soon, I don't know when, we'll see the wounded women and men lining the walls of American streets, hands out begging for something to eat. Support the troops.
It's Country Joe McDonald.
Support the troops.
Formerly of Country Joe and the Fish. Remember that song, What If They Gave a War and No One Came? That was Country Joe and the Fish, wasn't it? Wasn't that, Scott? What If They Gave a War and No One Came? Wasn't that Country Joe and the Fish? Yeah, I don't recall. Scott's not sure. In any case, it's my recollection. Anyhow, Country Joe McDonald, countryjoe.com is his website. He's got a new song out called Support the Troops. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Gary in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. As a person hoping for an Al Gore Hillary Clinton ticket in 2008.
Dream on.
Well,
I think that any ticket that had Al Gore on it, I would vote for, I have to say, right off the bat. But I don't.
Wouldn't it be interesting, though?
Yeah, I don't think that Al Gore has the stomach for another campaign against these guys, and I don't think that Hillary is going to be number two for anybody. So I doubt that that ticket would happen. But that's just, you
okay.
know, I've been wrong before.
Oh, I've been wrong many more times than you.
Yeah.
But anyway, I just keep trying. Anyway.
There you go.
Anyway, I just wonder, I want your opinion on this, truly. I just wonder if President Bush and the United States just may strike first here hard somewhere militarily because...
With regard to Iran,
you're
talking about?
Well, I don't know where, though. I just have a gut feeling that, I don't know, just something in my gut that there's a chance that the United States may strike somewhere hard and fast.
I think that you're probably right. And because Bush, I mean, it's what happens to a rat when it gets cornered? It strikes out, even though it's small and you're big. And I have been suggesting now for some time, I don't know how, half a year at least, that in my opinion, that Bush was not going to attack Iran, that he was going to attack Syria first, that he was going to go after a smaller country. And for a while, it looked like they were trying to set that up. And then Syria, started all these agreements with the CIA to, you know, joint to this and joint that, and we'll interrogate your prisoners for you, and we'll do this and that and the other thing. But I still think it's on the table. But what wouldn't surprise me even more than Bush attacking either Syria or Iran would be a surrogate of the United States attacking Iran or Syria and that drawing us in, for example, Israel. And and that drawing us into that kind of a situation. It would be tragic, frankly. But although I Ariel Sharon, as much as I disagree with a lot of his policies, I mean, it looks to me like maybe probably he's doing a good thing, you know, pulling out of Gaza. And hopefully it will lead to peace in the Middle East. Even if the conspiracy theorists who think that Sharon is doing it for other reasons are right. I mean, whether or not, you know, I'm don't pretend to be an expert on Middle Eastern politics or on Israel, although I've spent a fair amount of time there and I have some good friends who live there. But nonetheless, I doubt, I'm starting to wonder whether Sharon would even want to get dragged into this thing, to what extent he's willing to be the bad guy, and to what extent Israel's really all that worried about Iran. I don't know. I think that the area is small enough that I don't think anybody in that area is going to be real enthusiastic about using nuclear weapons in that area or starting any kind of conflict that might lead to that. So the mutually assured destruction theory certainly works better in a small area like that than it does, than it did between us and the Soviet Union. And it worked pretty good between us and the Soviet Union for 40, 50 years. But, who knows?
Yeah. To switch course here, just for a second here.
Oh, we have 15 seconds.
I just feel the Republican Party is very consistent on one thing. It's easy to be critical, but it's harder to be correct.
Yeah, well, and the Democrats have no shortage of that either. I mean, let's be honest here. I think it's important that we be articulating that the Democratic Party and the Greens and the Progressives and everybody else be articulating some sort of a positive vision out of this whole thing. And frankly, I think with regard to Iraq, it's quite clear to me that we have long ago passed the point where we are more source of problem than cure of problem. And therefore, the best thing we could do would be to pull out very quickly. Declare victory and leave. Thanks for the call, Gary. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No doubt the Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
Impeachment, the most beautiful word I ever heard.
War is not my first choice.
Impeachment, 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 impeachment.
I hope this can be done peacefully.
Every beautiful hope for the world in a single word.
The American people can know that every measure has been taken to avoid war. He will be disarmed by force.
Impeachment, impeachment, impeachment. John Conyers is thinking impeachment. The British press revealed the lies that Bush concealed. Oh my, impeachment. I wonder where Bush's long reach went. His war plan is a bust. He's someone you can trust to lie. Impeachment. Say it loud so the world can hear you.
No doubt.
Say it soft, let Republicans fear you.
No doubt.
Impeachment.
Hopefully this can be done peacefully.
It's time to start saying impeachment.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 26 minutes before the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Just to give you an update on what's going on with Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, Texas. First of all, she is running an advertisement on the local TV stations in which she looks into the camera. It's just a close-up of Cindy's head looking into the camera, of her face looking in the camera, as she speaks directly to George W. Bush, since he has a TV and he lives in that area.
Mr. President, my name is Cindy Sheehan. On April 4, 2004, my son Casey was killed in Iraq. He was only 24, and he died in his best friend's arms. Casey was so good and so honest. Why can't you be honest with us? You were wrong about the weapons of mass destruction. You were wrong about the link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. You lied to us. And because of your lies, my son died. You said he died for a noble cause. What cause? Mr. President, I want to tell you face to face how much this hurts. I love my country, but how many more of our loved ones need to die in this senseless war? How many more soldiers have to die before we say enough? I know you can't bring Casey back, but it's time to admit mistakes and bring our troops home now.
That Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, Texas right now, standing, you know, outside the street, down the road from Bush's hobby ranch, his 1,600-acre hobby ranch. And on their blog, they talk about, you know, what's going on there. You can find this, by the way, if you go to MoveOn.org, you can find out about the vigils, or if you go to MeetWithCindy.org, and then there's a CrawfordUpdate.blogspot.com is the blog. The morning activity, about an hour ago, we got a phone call from our friends up at Camp Casey saying that the line of grave markers along the road, Arlington West, had been run over. People there said that as they were talking to a few members of the press, a pickup truck came down the road, stopped at the fork by the edge of the tents. The driver then jumped out and attached a pipe to the undercarriage with a chain and began to swerve into the line of crosses. Then we heard the pipe being dragged over the grave markers and the pickup's wheels crushing them. Out of the 800 crosses, 500 were knocked down, and 100 are irreparable. However, the driver was arrested by local authorities. This is a prime example of how the Crawford Sheriff's Department has helped to protect us and our freedom of speech over the past week and a half. A big thank you to them. And then this posting a few hours later, we woke up this morning and headed over to Camp Casey to see what we could do to pitch in. Some media were already there filming and talking to Camp Casey folks. The irony of the situation was that the guy who drove his truck through the Memorial of White Crosses claims to be a, quote, real Christian, end quote. I'm not sure how much more ironic it can get. Some of the best pictures coming soon show two Iraq war veterans resetting the crosses and piecing together the remains. I must say it's pretty incredible to see veterans tear up in front of a memorial that they helped create. And then the most recent post from, I'm not sure what time zone this posting is listed in. It's either from about 40 minutes ago or from an hour and 40 minutes ago. Wow, ask and ye shall receive. This morning, over 30 dozen long-stem roses arrived via FedEx from a supporter in Florida. Simply incredible. We're still sorting through them to see who exactly sent them. Then they're on their way up to Arlington West to be placed over each memorial. A big thank you to our friends in Florida. So that's the the latest on what's going on with Cindy Crawford and her vigil Cindy Sheehan and her vigil in Crawford, Texas. Boy, is that an easy one to mangle in your brain. My apologies. The Washington Post, by the way, has announced that it is no longer going to participate with the Pentagon in this so-called Freedom Walk next month. Believe it or not, the Department of Defense has got this pro-Iraq war singer, Clint Black, this guy who's come up with a song about how wonderful the war in Iraq is. And they've got him, they're going to do a festival, they're going to do a party and have this guy sing at it on 9/11. It's going to be a march from the Pentagon I'd have to go back and look to one of the monuments there. I think it might be the Washington Monument. And they're talking about creating a Pentagon Memorial. Well, that's fine to remember the people who died on 9/11, the Pentagon Memorial Fund. But originally the Washington Post had said that it would donate some advertising space, you know, that has value for this. And when they figured out that what really is going on is that Don Rumsfeld is perpetuating this neocon lie that the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq and the occupation of Iraq, was in some way related to what happened on 9/11, when in fact there is no relation between the two. There is no connection between the two. As George Bush said in a rare moment of candor,
we've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September 11th.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. So George Bush says there's no connection. Of course, you know, as soon as he said that, they hustled him off and all the spin began. But anyhow, the Pentagon now is trying to wrap 9/11 and Iraq together. And they're very separate things. We were in Afghanistan going after Osama bin Laden, who is apparently the perpetrator of 9/11, or at least the financier and inspiration of it. And in the middle of that effort in Afghanistan, Bush decided, hey, now's a good time to go after Iraq. And it actually was a very good time for Bush to go after Iraq because it was timed around the 2002 elections. You know, pushing that thing through Congress just in time to influence the 2002 elections to take the Senate back so that they could run an ad where Max Cleland, the guy who had lost three limbs in Vietnam, morphing his face back and forth with him and Osama bin Laden. Well, it wasn't morphing. It was, you know, flashing on the screen. But Max Cleland and Osama bin Laden, so that Max Cleland could be defeated by Saxby Chambliss, a Republican who during the Vietnam War got out with a medical deferment that he was too physically unfit to participate in the Vietnam War. This is the guy who ran against Max Cleland and claimed that Max Cleland was unpatriotic and soft on defense. How could that be possible? Well, it was because of the war hysteria that the Bushies were whipping up. And surprise, surprise, you get the Republicans back in control of the Senate, and bang, now they've got their war. And why did they have their, well, as Bush said long ago and far away, back in 1999, he said that if he ever got the political capital, if he ever had the opportunity to invade Iraq, that he wouldn't fritter it away. He's not gonna waste that kind of political capital. He's gonna use it. And he's not going to waste that. In fact, I think one of the biggest threats to George Bush is Cindy Sheehan repeating this. I saw her on Chris Matthews yesterday, and I was just amazed, because Matthews really gave her an opportunity to, that she didn't repeat what she had said in her testimony before John Conyers. This is Cindy Sheehan speaking before Congressman John Conyers' hearings.
On prefabricated and cherry-picked intelligence, Iraq was no threat to the United States of America, and the devastating sanctions and bombing raids against Iraq were working. As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president. From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
Cindy Sheehan speaking before Congressman Conyers. Congressman Conyers, one of the most extraordinary and brave members of the United States Congress, I have to say. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, if you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts on this. Dave in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. We'll be having a couple of these candlelight vigils, Stand With Cindy, here. One, I think, in Eureka, and I know for sure in Arcata, and I will certainly be at one of them.
That's great. Yes, people can go to moveon.org and just plug in their zip code, and you'll get all the local ones that are happening near you.
Uh-huh.
Tomorrow night.
I had called because you'd made the statement that the intelligent move for the president, the administration right now, would be to simply declare a victory and pull out. But that, I think, belies the motivations of what's going on there, which most of the time I learned from listening to you and similar. But it had to do with the New World Order plan that went back to the earliest days. And it has to do
New
with
World Order being a phrase that Bush's father used as president.
Yeah, and it's the PNAC plan, though, that's going to be extreme power and wealth to a very small ruling cartel.
Yeah, the Project for New American Century, newamericancentury.org is their website. They're not at all reluctant to talk about this, by the way, Dave. They put it right out there.
Well, I think if they had it to do over again, that wouldn't be the case, but it's been out and there's no way to hide it now. And so,
yeah.
But this was no stretch did we blunder our way in there. This is very much an on-course, on-target, and it's being perpetrated by people who really don't give a damn about how many people they harm to gain what they are looking to gain.
Tragically, I have to agree with you.
Yeah. I'd like to think that we would never have that kind of a government befall a great nation like this, but I fear we have got some of the hardest, you know, words that we'd shy away from, but I think they are criminals. They are people that don't mind staging an event that hurts and kills a lot of people to justify whatever they want to do.
Yeah, and that certainly has happened. Dave, thank you very much for sharing that with us and for calling. Logan in New York City is on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's up? I just think it's appalling also how they are able to use 9/11 by saying that, you know, the post-9/11 world, it's the more cautious thing to do, to go into Iraq.
I mean, that's
what they're saying.
Yeah.
But my question to you is why the Democrats are completely ignoring Cindy Sheehan, and except for maybe Howard Dean. But do you think he'll go down there?
Howard Dean? No, I don't think he will, and I don't think it would be appropriate for him to. He's not his own man right now. He's the head of the Democratic Party, and so he has to, you know, his primary job has to be to help lead the Democratic Party, and the party as a whole hasn't taken a position on this, and while I think it should, you know, it's the party hasn't decided to, so there you go.
It looks like it's, I mean, with their weakness, the only thing that's really going to get any attention is demonstrations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, unfortunately, I have a feeling that not unlike during the Vietnam era, the Democratic Party is going to be in the back. You know, they're going to lead from the rear, as it were. And this is the thing that haunts the Democrats is McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy, and you know, the terrible defeat that he had at the hands of Richard Nixon around the issue of the Vietnam War. You know, that they are convinced, the Democrats at the senior level, they're convinced that being anti-war means losing elections. And I frankly think that Americans today are far more sophisticated and far more clearly recalling the lessons of Vietnam than they were during Vietnam. You know, during Vietnam, there were still people who were trying to compare Vietnam to World War II and getting away with it.
But they behave like they're competing for the same constituency as the Republicans. And there's a huge constituency that they're just ignoring. For what reason?
They're not ignoring them. They're taking them for granted. They're taking us for granted. They're assuming that we'll be there to vote for them when the time comes because we don't have any alternative. And that's a very, very dangerous assumption to be making on their part. Logan, I'm convinced that that's what they're doing. Yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. David in San Francisco. David, we've got about a minute left. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. A couple of things. I'll try to do them as quick as possible. Gene McCarthy actually did quite well with the Democrats, and in Chicago, all of his delegates came to the Chicago convention and were actually locked out. So he did very well in the Democratic Party, enough to have actually been substantial, and the Democratic Party did their best to refuse them admission.
Right. He never became president of the United States.
Right, but he would have had a real chance at the Democratic Convention in '68, he was actually a war hero in his own right. He was any number of
different. He was, and you know, that really wasn't emphasized ever, unfortunately.
Right. My other issue, you had the earlier guest about nukes, one thing that's not known commonly about the Iran. They have contracted to build this nuclear power plant, and unfortunately they didn't contract with either General Electric or Westinghouse, who own CBS and NBC. These are the creeps that are stirring up the hatred. The Russians essentially have a company that the bid was accepted. So,
right. And that's the tragedy, because the original deal was with the Shah of Iran. I mean, we helped them start that nuclear program when the Shah was in there, and it was going to be American companies. But
right,
it's not now. They're upset about it. David, thanks for the call. I got to run. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no trouble.
The tyranny of the clock here. Appreciate the call, though. Great to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
If you knew that you would die today, you saw the face of God and love, would you change? Would you change?
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 5 minutes before the hour. Oh, my goodness. We had a discussion going on in the chat room here that I would just dropped in on. Which you can get to, by the way, by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat, about whether or not George Bush is truly a sociopath or whether he's just, you know, kind of an average guy or even a very smart guy, whatever, who got kind of duped and dragged into things. You know, are the powers larger than him or is his own sociopathy driving this? There have been some stories in the media recently about how George Bush has been, over the last 6 months, descending into rages. And some of the White House internal memos where people are talking to each other in the White House and they're putting out, you know, notices of meetings and things are having weather forecasts associated with them with words like, you know, calm skies and stormy weather and stuff like that, indicating that Bush is on a rampage. And if you get into his office, he's going to start screaming and throwing things, or that he's very, very happy and he's smiling and he's being very nice to people. And, you know, is this the post-alcohol syndrome? Is this the result of years and years of alcoholism? Or is this, you know, a sociopath at work? Or is this just, you know, stories coming out of the White House by people who don't like George Bush and they're trying to harm him politically? I don't honestly know. I don't have a clue, but it's an interesting speculation. My inclination is that he's probably sociopathic, but you know, and the stories about him killing, you know, putting firecrackers in frogs when he was a kid and delighting in exploding little animals, that's a bad sign, generally speaking. But speaking as a former psychotherapist, that's a bad sign. John G. Roberts, speaking of bad signs, John G. Roberts criticized three Republican congresswomen for supporting the radical idea of comparable worth, that is, equal pay between men and women, back in 1984. One of those three congresswomen that he criticized for being radicals, in fact, he said their slogan may as well be from each according to his ability to each according to her gender, paraphrasing Marx. One of those three women that he criticized for saying that women should get equal pay with men was Olympia Snowe, who is now a senator from Maine and will be voting on Roberts' nomination. It's going to be interesting to see how this one shakes out. We find also today that Judge Roberts believed that the decision of the Supreme Court overturning an Alabama law requiring prayers in school every day, he said, the conclusion of the High Court that the Constitution prohibits such a moment of silent reflection or even silent prayer seems indefensible. Indefensible. Interesting. So his true colors are starting to come out. This guy is an extremist. Capital E. Well, hopefully the Democrats will figure this out. Somebody call him up and tell him. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.